Good morning. I think we'll get started. It's 8:45. I'm sure there'll be another couple people drifting in, but let's get started. We have a busy agenda today, and I'd like to do what we can to get through as much as possible before 11 o'clock. With that, I will ask for the roll call. Yes. Can everybody hear okay?
Sounds good online.
Sounds good online.
Stella Sport. She's here. Maria Russell. Robert Mackey.
Here.
Evelyn Pinsgord. Sarah Batiste. Deb Gibson.
Good morning. Evelyn is here.
Here.
Thanks, Evelyn. Mary Alice Short.
Here.
Debbie Gonzalez.
I'm here.
Kayla Hansen. Nicole Klupfer. Carolyn Simmons.
Here.
Debbie Coxon.
Here.
Gary Newman.
Here.
Jennifer Elhard. Mary Sue Date.
Present.
Claudia Coach. Jennifer Ward. Kim Eames. Heather Labengood. Robin Winant.
Here.
Jedediah Lowell.
Here.
John Clendenin.
Present.
Jennifer Youngberg.
Here.
Walker Wheeler. Brad Crick.
Here.
Travis Brinzow.
Sorry, Nicole, I'm present here. I just couldn't say it. I was muted.
I'm sorry, who is that?
This is Walker Online.
Oh, thanks. Richard Machida.
Here.
Gary Bender.
Here.
Britton Anderson. Is there anybody whose name was not called? Thanks.
Thank you, Nicole. So if everybody could take a look at the agenda, please.
Move to approve.
I'll second.
I wanted to make one amendment. I'd like to add a conversation about the tuition waiver under new business. Let's see where we're going to do that. No, we were going to do that under new business after healthcare.
I'd make that motion.
I'll accept as a second.
Thank you. Any other amendments to the agenda? Okay, seeing none, I'll call for a vote. Was there a second on the motion?
Yes, Gary Bender.
Everybody in favor of the agenda, please say aye.
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 Thank you. And any opposed? Okay, agenda is accepted as amended. Please take a look at the minutes from February. I'll give you a couple minutes to look over them.
And this is Heather Levengood. I just joined in.
Thank you.
I move to approve.
This is Gary Bender, second.
Thank you. If there is no opposition, can I hear any opposition to approving the minutes as they stand? Okay, seeing none, we'll accept the minutes as final. And we will move on. We have nothing in pending actions at the moment. We do have a public comment at 9. I'm not sure people are maybe here yet, so
I know that our Associate Vice Chancellor of Facility Services, Scott Bell, is here at the table with us. And I'd just like to not only introduce Scott to those of you who don't know him, he is a wonderful asset for our university and has been at several staff council meetings, and we appreciate his attendance just to kind of keep him informed of what our issues are, but I'd also like to give him the chance to say a couple words about facility services and give you all an opportunity to ask short questions.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Scott Bell, and head of facility services, and I don't have a lot to say today, but just wanted to let folks know that on the Fairbanks campus, it's going to be a busy summer as far as construction goes, particularly in the area of the Patty Building and the Banana parking lot. We're going to be putting Utilidor down the roadway there, so we're going to be disrupting the traffic along Panama Drive. Also, we're going to be putting a sewer line up South Candelar, which goes is the road that goes up from Dysfunction Junction up into the area between Wickersham and Greening. So there's going to be a lot of disruption on campus. We're trying to phase it so that we keep areas passable with some detours, but be able to get everywhere. We have a map. I have a draft version of it in front of me here, and the final markup on it, and that will be posted here this week so that you'll be able to see the different projects and the areas of campus will be impacting. That's really all I have to say today.
Any questions for Scott?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for coming. Will the Fairbanks Street Bridge be open? Do we anticipate that bikes or pedestrians will have to reroute?
My understanding is the bridge will be open. Let me find out, though, because we'll be working from the site of the Alaska Energy Center site, putting the Utilidor from that point directly west down the road. Let me make sure that they're going to leave some passageway there open. I'll check that. Thanks.
Any other questions for Scott? Okay, so seeing none, I think we'll move on. Scott, thank you for being here.
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing online.
Okay, we'll see what we can do to adjust that. Is it everybody or was it just Scott?
Yeah, this is Gary. I would agree. I think it's everybody from you guys' end.
Okay, we'll try to turn that up a little bit, and Nicole is on the job.
Thanks.
With your permission, I would like to be able to be flexible with our guest comments, only because we have a really full agenda with important things that we need to talk about, and I hate to have a guest wait for half an hour, 45 minutes, or an hour. So with the okay of this body, I'd like to be able to insert guests when they come to get them in and out if they need to. Is anybody opposed to me doing that? Okay, thank you. I know we're going to have at least one guest and maybe two, so I will fit them in when it's convenient.
This is Walker online. Pips, I don't have any problem with doing that, but let's just make sure that we're timely with them if we can.
That's a good point. So with that, I don't see, is there anybody who would like to speak to guest comments who is in the room currently? Okay, so seeing none, we're going to move on. I apologize for not having a president's report this month. It's the first month that I have dropped the ball, and I have been juggling too many needed to drop. So I'm sorry that you don't have one. It's been, Jewel and I both have been pretty slammed over the last couple of weeks. This reached a new high with lots of things that are going on, in addition to a two-day Staff Alliance retreat in Anchorage last week and two daughters who are recovering from knee surgeries in one capacity or another. So I apologize. But I think everything that I would have said in my report is going to come out in this meeting and in much greater detail. So I will just leave it at that. Jewel and I think I'm going to keep my president's report really short because we have a lot of important matters to discuss today, and I'd rather just be able to open the agenda up for those kinds of things. So with that, I'm going to move to pass it to Jewel, and you can say what you'd like for vice president's report.
Is am I on? Okay. I'm going to keep it really short except to say Staff Alliance met in a two-day retreat last Thursday and Friday. Actually, Thursday was the retreat and Friday was the business meeting. Thursday, we had extended sessions on the healthcare benefit and another session on compensation. We also talked about governance and a couple of other topics. Under the healthcare benefit, we talked about the tobacco free hiring policy, the tuition waiver, numerous other items. Then under compensation, we talked about the GeoDiff Staff Alliance accepted UA Staff Council's motion on the geographic differential. It's been added to our compensation working group, and then let's see, we talked about longevity, the fairness of the current system for rewarding employees, the unfairness of the current system, I should say. We talked about our constitution and bylaws. We talked about the effects of the ASEA organizing effort on governance and its relationship with the administration. And there were several other things, but they will all come out in other items in the agenda. So that's the extent of my report, unless you have any questions.
Okay. Thanks, Tuella. Our next agenda item would be remarks by Chancellor Rogers. He is at a President's Cabinet meeting today, and he's going to join us when he can. So that will be another interruption at some point during the agenda. He asked if he could just call in when he was done with that, which will be later in our meeting. So moving on to, well, we're really going quickly here. It's going to slow down soon. Number six, governance. Kathy, are you online? Kathy Cahill, President of Faculty Senate. I don't think Kathy's here. Mari, are you online as President of ASUAF? Okay, no Mari as well. So that moves us on to unfinished business, and I'd like everybody to take out the proposal that I sent earlier about Staff Council strategic direction. I hope everybody's had a chance to read that. Oh, I know. So essentially, I'll just give a quick background, and then I'd like to move into conversation about this proposed reorganization. As you know, at the beginning of the year, Chancellor Rogers asked both me and Tuella to think about how we do business and how we might be more effective at doing business. It kind of was in parallel with a lot of the things that the president is doing at his level, looking at processes on the university and challenging ourselves to do things differently if need be and cut out excess procedures that don't need to be there and streamline and just really think about the effectiveness of our organization as a university, but then all the different smaller pieces that make up that university. Joelle and I have thought about this a long time. We've talked with lots of you in private conversations or in as a conversation of this body. So what we have in front of us now is a proposal that we've put together based on some of your comments, some of our thoughts, meetings with Chancellor Rogers. Essentially, the proposal is looking at four different things. Currently, we have a staff council that has 34 seats on it. As you can see here, we don't have those 34 seats represented at all of our meetings. So the proposal is that we would staff council would be comprised of 17 at-large representatives with staggered two-year terms. We would maintain a ratio of off-campus representatives to on-campus representatives with the same as the overall ratio of employees at UAF, so making sure that we have rural representatives on staff council. We would add a seat to the executive board that was primarily responsible for communication, which is one of the issues that we've talked about a lot this year and John has tried to address in the communications committee. And we wanted to also make sure that nobody who's currently seated at staff council would be in jeopardy of losing their seats. This would just be a transition that would happen at the end of these cycles. I think you all got the attachments from the survey, the 2009 survey that we did. Some numbers that Nicole's put together on staff council participation and the letter that I wrote requesting information earlier in the year. So we've started talking, we've had several
several preliminary conversations about how we can be doing our business better. I think with the really important and swift changes that we see happening right here, both in healthcare and in our benefit package, I think this is the time to really be critical in making sure that we are posed well to be a body that's effective, that's communicating well, that's active, and that is visible on campus, because we are going to need to hear it. We are going to need to have a voice. This is how we are represented, where we are the body that represents thousands of staff members around the state, especially when you consider our relationship with Staff Alliance and how all staff members are represented at Staff Alliance, not just UAF. So there are a lot of big issues that are in front of us right now. I think it's really important that you feel that you're working toward and working with a really effective staff council. So I'd like to open it up for comments. I know that you probably don't all agree on maybe all these points, but if there's some things that you do agree with, if you do agree with the whole thing, that's great. So I'd like to kind of open that up for discussion. So if there's somebody who has comments, please.
This is Mary Sue. I just have one thing I'd like a little clarification on. So you're saying that we have 34 right now seats, and we're talking about just cutting that in half and going to...
Right. And the rationale behind that was twofold. One is we have only a percentage of those seats that are even filled. And so, you know, we always have lots of seats that are open, so why have that big a body? The second would be that on the vast majority of boards, that would be considered a huge board, an unwieldy number. And so we're trying to get it down to a board that is seen as efficient and including a really dedicated group of people, which I see sitting in front of me. I mean, I don't see the composition changing. I see how we're defining ourselves on paper changing to be really, really indicative of what's happening. And it's not something that if you, like, oh, I want to go sign up for staff council, I'll just put my name down and sign up. That this is something that's worthwhile, and it takes energy and some commitment.
I don't necessarily agree with the number that I'm saying.
The number ended up as a compromise between people who wanted something much smaller and where we are right now. So I think, is that fair to say, Juella? There were suggestions about having an 11 member or a 13 member, and I think that's been brought back up to something that we felt would be more palatable.
How does it fit within the membership requirements for? One person for every constituent?
Our current rule is that each council member represents up to 50 staff members. So if we split it in half, you know, the ratio would be about double of that. But we are proposing at-large membership, which is what the other staff councils do. We're different from the other staff councils in that we currently are representing units. And as we've talked about before, the unit designation is a little bit arbitrary. It's just a way of counting staff council members.
So we'd be within BOR policy with a 1-to-100 ratio, is what you're saying. We don't have to. There's no numerical requirement on staff council.
That's right. Yeah, there is no numerical. There's no ratio that we have to meet. As far as I know, there's no Board of Regent policy that dictates that we need to meet some number for representation.
Staff Council as a group decided on that when it was originally formed. All those powers were delegated to us.
Thank you.
Gary?
Well, we've had discussions about this, and I understand the challenges. I'm not sure that if you had 17 members, you'd actually wouldn't end up with half as many just trying to do the work of twice as many that we have now. I guess I'm a little concerned, first of all, comparing us with Anchorage and Juneau campuses. I think we're a lot more heterogeneous. I think we're a lot more spread out. And I think the unit designation has some value in making sure that there's kind of representation from all walks of the campus, if you will, spread as we are. So I'd like to, I don't know if you've discussed maybe splitting this to say, well, there'll be one rep per unit, and then there could be a handful of at-larges to make up whatever number you come up with. But I'd feel a lot more comfortable with something along those lines, just to keep the connection to the local constituency. Because you could end up with a very skewed board, people doing stuff in from some area that happen to have the flexibility to do that, and there'd be other people that they would have no idea who they're voting for. They would just be out of their main sphere of reference. So I'm a little concerned about that.
Thanks, Gary. I think you know, you and I have talked about this before, and I appreciate your thoughts on that. I guess my thoughts in response are twofold. Some of the units right now are a conglomeration of lots of smaller units put together. So the unit doesn't necessarily, I think for some people on council, represent a cohesive group or a cohesive body. That's certainly the case in my unit at the Chancellor's, in the Chancellor's unit. It's, you know, a couple of dozen smaller units that aren't necessarily connected either geographically or through department. I think that if there was a unit that say the Geophysical Institute, which is kind of more unit-like than some of the other ones, there's nothing to preclude that there aren't one or two or three representatives from GI, say, just as an example, and those. That communication could still happen the same way. I think people at GI would look to the person who is at GI to run and get information. So I don't see that as necessarily being a drawback. I think that communication or that sense of connectedness can still happen at the will of the representative. John?
I think at the risk of diversity, though, we might want to look at how we group units, maybe, because realistically speaking, if you go completely at large, you might look at like somebody with the hundreds of employees that GI has as being able to have 17 representatives from one aspect of the university without the diversity of the rest of the university, based on just their willingness to get involved in campaigns. So, I mean, you lose that diversified aspect of the entire university that way.
Keep in mind that half of this 17 member, it would rotate every year. There would be an annual election with half of the group up for re-election.
And at one point, this is Debbie Gonzalez, at one point there was some discussion of having a proportional representation to, you know, research units, rural, et cetera, those kind of designations too. So,
I have a question about lowering the amount to 17 from 34. With the amount of, you're saying we have an average of 17 people show up to every meeting, and I agree with Gary's concern about if you have 17 people and, you know, a percentage of those don't show up, what happens? Are we going to change the consequences for people not showing up? My concern is that we're just going to, you know, we're going to have a handful of people making the decisions, and I wish there was a little bit more consequence for people not showing up to the meetings. I mean, they wanted to be on it, and then they decided not to come. So is there going to be a certain percentage of meetings that they don't show up to, that they get kicked off, and then they, you know, we have to fill the position with their alternate or something? I think that needs to be looked at if we're going to lower the amount of attendance to the committee.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. It's an idea that we've kind of tossed around a little bit this year and haven't moved forward on, but that's certainly something we could do. We wanted to keep the proposal as it stands here simple. There's things that we could do to increase the detailed to increase a lot of the details. but that's certainly something that has been on the table. Maybe we do need to start doing something a little bit more proactive about making sure that our membership is active and involved. I think with this proposal, there's lots of room for involving people who are not necessarily on staff council and don't have the time to commit to actually holding a seat on staff council. There's plenty of opportunities for people who are not holding a seat to be involved in committees, both internal and external. And so I see that my vision is to have a small, tight core of really active people, and then bring in other members other staff members to help with some of the smaller duties, say serving on a committee. I think right now we ask our staff council members to do an awful lot. Not only are you coming to meetings, but you're also, we are all making up every committee that we have, and we have a lot of committees. So I think the idea was to have a tight, active core of people who's willing to work hard and be involved at the highest level, and then a kind of a more diffuse group of people who are willing to serve on maybe one committee with a much smaller time commitment. Because that's an issue that I hear about a lot. I really like to be more involved in staff affairs, but with the commitments that I already have to staff council, I can't do that. And so trying to spread out that a little bit. Carolyn.
I have a real concern with the way these people are going to be selected. Speaking of the GI, we have over 400 people, staff members there. And if we don't have people voting for us, then we're going to be left without a representative. And it's going to, we're having trouble with communications already. And I see that issue just absolutely multiplying if we cut down on representation from the individual units. I think it's mandatory that we have at least one representative from each unit. And how we go about doing that, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to be critical, because otherwise I think communication is going to hit the bottom and we're going to have everybody dropping out.
So first, this is a concept that we're bringing to you, and the next steps are, should it meet, pass the vote here, is to go to the EMR for details and for working through how it would happen. In response to Carol, though, Carolyn, you have to keep in mind that right now units aren't being represented. We have units without representation, and we have units who are not being communicated to by their representative. We have council members who were elected by 5 votes or less. What we're trying to do here is to generate an enthusiasm and an excitement and bring together 17 individuals whose mission is to represent all staff at UAF. And then we have one individual whose focus is communicating with all staff at UAF. That's their responsibility. It falls on those 17 reps to be prepared and answer questions, but they work together as a group to work with that one communications member whose role is to get the word out. Instead of it falling on each of you as individual representatives, and the range in how communications are happening now is unbelievable, from zero to very well done. What we're trying to do is spread that, spread the successes. So the concept here is an attempt to make it easier for everyone. Both ways, communicating out and communicating back up with an effective group, as Tipsa said. So keep in mind the next steps. If you pass this today as a concept, then it goes to Walker and EMR to work out the details, which as a change to the Constitution, obviously, it has to be read twice before this body and approved twice. Then it has to go to the Chancellor for approval.
John?
I have to agree somewhat with Pips and Joella as far as the communication goes. You have, maybe 17 people in this room right now, including what we have online. And when we look at communications and what's actually going out from staff council members out to their units and out to the general staff, it is very little. So we might have a whole lot of representatives that actually send nothing out, and then they're basically non-represented. Just because you have a council member doesn't mean that there's any communication. So realistically, I think I agree with the concept of bringing it down into a smaller body of dedicated people that actually do the work and get those communications and get staff informed. There's no really way that we can really gather and communicate and make decisions as a staff body without the representation doing the work and without the staff actually getting those messages and then feeding back information so that we can send it out. So I do have to agree in that respect.
Brad.
I, you know, agree with some of the concerns that have been brought up by other people here this morning. I also agree with the problems that we're identifying with staff council as it is right now, the problem of membership, of participation. And I have two concerns that I don't think have been quite brought up yet. One is, and I'm glad to hear that we pushed back on the number of people for this proposal, that we have, by my count, 22 committees listed in our agenda at 17 people. I don't know, you know, how many people who are on staff council right now are on committees, if it really is that there are 17 people doing all 22 of these. But it seems to me that we're going to make the workload tougher for all 17 of these people. And one of the things that was identified in that survey is that people don't have time to participate in staff council. So that's one concern I have. The second is that one reason that also has come up in the survey and that I've heard from others is that participating in staff council seems ineffective. It seems ineffective because of unfair reasons. Oh, staff council doesn't do anything. Well, that's not true, not entirely. And some of that is staff council's not effective because the administration isn't listening, which is also not entirely true, but there's something to that. And I don't see that being addressed by this. You know, the reason for people not participating isn't necessarily how staff council is set up, it's how they feel about how the university is responding to them. And I don't think this is going to change that.
I guess I appreciate your thoughts. I appreciate your thoughts, Fred. In speaking to your first point about lots of committees and lots of responsibilities that this board has to attend to, the idea would be, I think, with this proposal that there'd be this strong core of dedicated people, but then we would bring in people beyond that 17 to actually help with some of these things, which we don't do right now. So I think that was the intent to spread out the workload a little bit, but have a really dedicated central core of people. And I think along with a change can be a really nice marketing campaign to say, hey, this is your new staff council. This is the new way of doing things. This is a dedicated group of people. We want you to be involved. We could really send the signal that we are being critical of ourselves. We're taking a hard look at the way we do things. We're proposing something new, and this is an exciting time to be a staff member. It's also a critical time to be a staff member, as I'm sure that you're well aware of, with a lot of the big issues that we're being tasked to attend to right now, that we're being asked to react to because we're being told what's going to happen. So I think Richard had, and before I get to you, can I just ask if Chancellor Rogers was online? I heard the phone beep. Okay, so let's. I think we'll give this another couple minutes, and then we're going to have to move on. So we'll go from Richard, and go from there.
Just a real quick question about the second point. Based on current staff members, what would the off-campus representation drop?
You know,
one person.
What's that? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole.
Oh, based on our current distribution of employees, what would the number of off-campus representatives drop?
You know what? That's a good question, and I'm not sure. We just wanted to make sure we had talked about
we talked about making sure that there was rural representation, and so that was the main point. If that needs to get tweaked a little bit, we can do that. I don't know what the exact ratio is, but it was important to the chancellor and me and Joelle and everybody that I talked to that we had significant rural participation. So we wanted to make that the caveat that we put in, but we can check into that.
If you count Unit 1 and Unit 2 together, it's like 14% of the overall staff numbers. But not everyone on Unit 1 and Unit 2 is off campus, and there are people in other units who are off campus. So I don't know if that's going to be that would be a final number, but that's what I estimated this morning.
Hey, Pips, this is Jennifer and Stewart. I came in a little bit late, but I've been listening, and I have to say, when listening to everybody's concerns and stuff, I want to say that first of all, I agree that change needs to be done, and I think we're on the right track. If it's executed properly in the right way and it's supported from up above us, I think all of the staff body can be happy about this if, again, it gets executed the right way in a positive manner. If the elections get done properly, you know, those people of 17 constituents get advertised correctly, then maybe the whole staff body would be able to get to know you, and it would take away the concern about the units being represented if that particular individual is acknowledged through the whole staff body and introduced correctly. But again, we can't self-advertise. We need it to happen from above us. And not in an email. It needs to come from a letter or straight from the chancellor's mouth or something in order for it to have a little bit of, you know, strength to it. So I think we're on the right track. I think it just needs to be executed correctly.
Thanks, Jennifer. John?
I just kind of, I think the whole issue warrants some really looking into from EMR. I think it all has to be passed through the body anyway, so I think it really warrants a dedicated group of people actually looking at it, maybe bringing it into dealing with the details and how to best execute it and how to make it so that it's effective. It's not going to just go off on a whim. It's going to have to go through this body to really be organized and structured. So I think it really warrants being looked at.
Okay, I think because we have so much on our agenda, I'd like to wrap up this conversation. Is there anybody who would be willing to call for a vote on this at this time?
Just to send it to EMR. Point of clarification,
sure.
Are we voting on all the specifics here, or are you charging EMR with coming up with a workable plan?
Right now, you have a concept in front of you. And so the idea would be to take this concept, forward it to EMR, and work out some of the details.
So they have the flexibility to look at some of the options.
Exactly.
I would so move.
Is there a second?
I second.
Okay, I think just to make sure that I know there's a bunch of people online, so I'm going to ask for a vote, a verbal vote in the room, a hand vote in the room, and a verbal vote on the phone so we can make sure that we're recording this correctly. So everybody in favor of moving this to EMR for moving our concept to EMR for further detail workup, say, or raise your hand, please.
And Ryan, you can vote.
And online, please say aye one at a time so we can make sure people in favor of moving this on.
Aye.
Aye.
I think that was two. I think we have three
two.
Far. Is
have
that
two.
Right?
Aye.
Debbie.
Okay, you know what? We're going to have to do this by name.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start again online. So if somebody could Robert. Robert.
Aye.
Walker.
Aye.
Gary?
Aye.
Debbie?
Aye.
Jennifer?
Aye.
And have I missed anybody online?
Deb Jepson, aye.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Deb Jepson,
thank you.
Aye. And
Kayla Hansen, thank you.
And aye. And Heather Levengood, aye.
And Heather.
Evelyn Pensgert, aye.
And Evelyn. Okay, is there anybody else online that we have missed? Okay, so now we'll go for opposed. If you're opposed in the room, please raise your hand. Thank you. And any opposition online? Okay, hearing none, we will see what the tally is from Nicole. Oh, yeah, sorry. Are there any abstains? I'm sorry. Abstentions. One abstention in the room. Are there any abstentions online? Okay, thank you. I'm going to let Nicole do a quick tally, and then we will move on to Michelle Bartlett.
Bips, this is Kathy Cahill. Did I come in too late? Or did I just miss a call?
You, we've modified our agenda a little bit. So let me get you right after Michelle. If you have about 10 minutes, Kathy, do you have that much time?
I'm fine. I just got you guys on mute. So
wonderful. Thank you. So Nicole has tallied the votes. We have 14 aye, 4. We have 6 against and 1 abstention. So with that, we will send this concept to EMR and be able to talk about it at the next meeting. So thank you all for your input and conversation. Very much appreciated. And with that, I think we'll move on to Michelle Bartlett, the Director of Summer Sessions, who is here to lead us on a very different topic.
Thank you for allowing me to come today. And yeah, we always look forward to talking to Deaf with Deaf Council. I can tell you, maybe I'm supposed to be comic relief today. Between this conversation and you're going to go on to health care,
Hold them.
Am I supposed to eat it?
There
yeah.
It does have to be ridiculously close.
I apologize.
Pretend
anyway.
Like you're at Davis with a mic right up.
Thank you. Like ice cream cone, right? Just like an ice cream cone, only we don't have free ice cream. Anyway, we're talking about summer sessions and lifelong learning, and I know that everybody here at the table is more than familiar with it, but I wanted to, I also know that you all, because of your positions within your units, you are sometimes the first person on that people run into. And the worst thing that we can have is to have a program where that other people don't know about. We work really hard to get the word out for students. We work really hard to get the word out to staff. And we really work hard to get the word out to the community because we're an open enrollment institution, and we really want to open the doors of the university really, really wide. We have a real issue with students because most of them are not on the four-year plan. I go into classes and I talk about, ask how many of you are on the four-year plan. In a class of 45, does anybody here want to guess how many hands go up? One, maybe, two, three. And so that's not good. That's not good. We talk about the economics of it, and we've been continually in the summertime so that it can include bottleneck classes because, like, anatomy and physiology, which are really difficult for students to get into, and having those classes available to summer so that, in fact, they can graduate in 4 years, because here at our institution, as you know, 12 credits are considered to be full-time. But if you take 12 credits times 8 semesters, that's 96 credits. There's no degree that we offer, baccalaureate degree, that is for 96 credits. Most of them are 120. Engineering is about 134, and business is a little bit less than that. So one of the issues that we run into with students is the lack of money, the lack of money to go to school. That's a real, and until the last year with the performance scholarship, Alaska was 51st in the nation in needs-based scholarships. So in the summertime, because the kids really depend on going to school, and I mean working in the summer to get the money, we've come up with different incentives for students to go. One of them is we eliminated out-of-state tuition, so in-state tuition for all in the summertime. A second program, if you take 6 credits, we'll work with you to find a job on campus. And one of the best units that have picked up these kids is Scott's unit, working with Bear and the crew down there. They have picked up lots of kids in the summer. So if they take 6 credits, they can work. And what's wonderful is they work around their schedule, which if you're out in the workplace, they don't work around the schedule. A few years ago, we introduced this concept tuition awards because summer is a trailer as far as financial aid. Pell grants, they get them in the fall and spring, and if there's any money left over, they can use summer, but there is no money left over. I mean, realistically, Pell grants. So for students who need to work on their degree, we give 3-credit tuition awards for those students to take courses that they need to complete their degree. What's the requirement? The requirement is that it has to apply to your degree, and the second thing is that they have to pass it with a C or better, all right? And the last thing that we really have added was the Sweet Summer Deal, which was started last year, where we really want students to go full-time in the summer. And how can we make that happen? One of the ways that we can make it happen is if they take more than 10 credits, which really pushes them into the fourth class, which would make it full-time, then they can take up to 14 credits and they only have to pay for 10. Okay? And the requirement on that is they have to pass all their classes with a C or better. That's it. Not a C minus, not a C average, a C or better. That's all. We work with Mike Sprague so that the kids taking part in that would get a 28% discount if they stayed in the dorm. So we're putting all kinds of financial incentives for them to do that. In addition to that, this year we've teamed up with the Center for Distance Education. So not only, if you open up this flyer here all the way in, these are where all the credits, all the courses that summer session has, well, as of the day we published it, because you know it's static, it goes away. I mean, we keep adding to it. They have the 265 classes here, plus the 135 classes that CDE offers, so they have 400 opportunities to take advantage of the Sweet Summer Deals this summer. Again, what do we ask of them? They pass all of their classes with a C or better, and with CDE, and especially with CDE, because CDE's completion rate, as we all know, is really not as good as we want it to be. And so all the classes have to be done by the 18th of August. Okay? This thing is a lot different than the ones that we have used to be doing every year. The one that I took great pride in, the one you could take to the bathroom with you because it had everything that summer had to offer. People have asked us, what happened to that? And I said, what do our students do? Our students work with their thumbs. They don't work with big pieces of paper. They're all electronically, they're tied to the web. And there's no need to publish and cut down all these trees if the students aren't going to be using them. So we put all the essential information in here about the classes, the Sweet Summer Deal, the evening college. If you're working during the day, we've got 35 classes in the evening. There's weekend focus classes. If the kids start early, they can finish school in 3 years and 2 summers. We've got in-state tuition for all. We have the Writing Center, the Math Lab, and the Speaking Center available. It's all here. The one thing but this was a thing that really is tied that we distributed to the community this year. This was in the News Minor on the 16th of March. And that has all of the stuff that we invite the community to do. And we have activities going on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday this summer, all summer long. Got lots of things happening. We have, did you all know that Brian Rogers used to be manager of a band in the rock and roll band called the Glass Bead Gang? This was back in the 70s. Anyway, they're having a reunion on campus on the 6th of July on the depth of the Rasmussen Library. So we have that happening this year. We have Stephen Shore, the National Autism Expert, coming up. We're honoring Willie Hensley, who wrote, was the one that formed the basis of the Alaskan Native Land Claim Settlement Act when he was in J. Rabinowitz's class. Legacy Lecture is happening. Libby Casey is coming back. Lots of things happening. What I really want to remind you of is that you all have tuition waivers available to you. If you haven't used them, you get 6 credits a year, and you can use them. Why not take advantage of it in the summertime? Lots and lots of things available in the summer. And we end the summer with 2 shows of Mountain Stage, who are coming to Alaska for 2 live shows on the Davis Concert, in the Davis Concert Hall, on the 17th and 18th of August. Anybody have any questions? Yes, Jennifer.
I just wanted to make comment that I know that Wintermester, you guys had a great concept, and you allowed people to park in the gold parking lot.
Uh-huh.
I think that was really nice. Is there anything like that for the Maymester or summer in work?
Scott, did you hear that?
Parking in the gold lots for people who take these classes.
So what happens in the winter? In winter, because of the first 2 weeks of January, and they're pretty empty, and so we've made allowances. And actually, summer session has paid for an extra, whatever, $15 or something, so the kids could park, and they wouldn't have to walk when it's 40 below from the Nenana lot up. So she's asking, what's the chance of this happening during Maymester, which is the last 2 weeks of May?
I'll talk to Martin, who supervises that, and find out. I'm not sure of the duration of the gold permit holder's calendar there, how long they get to use that.
As a gold member, I can tell you.
Okay, good.
It's the end of May. It's the end of May. And so I know that there's that, the Maymester begins the Monday after graduation, and it goes to the last 2 weeks of the month. So the question is, some of the faculty are on campus, and they're not staying at home working from their home or whatever they would do. So there's probably more use, but if you could investigate it, it would be great.
Yeah, I think the challenge was if people pay for a gold permit for a certain period of time, they expect to be able to use it, and that seems reasonable. To get students in at the same time or the Maymester could cause some conflict. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Last year when that happened, because I do use the gold parking, and so others in my unit, and there were several complaints that they would come in to park, and they weren't able to find something because there would be other people parking that lot.
Mm-hmm. So it is an interesting balancing act. The first week in January is no problem. It's that second week, that's when people all of a sudden started coming back to work, and what they used to be able to count on, all of a sudden, where did these cars come from? Is that right? And that's it. So it's a balance. It's a nice thing, but it's not 40 below. One of the reasons we were accommodating it was because it was 40 below, and we just thought there's nothing like walking past empty parking lots at 40 below. Thank you, Scott.
You bet.
Michelle, I have one question for you. When you mentioned that if a student takes at least 6 credits and then you'll help them find a job on campus also?
That's correct.
Is that something summer sessions helps them do?
Yes, that's something that summer session helps them do. We've created a special student pool. So this is a perfect audience. Do y'all have any student jobs? You know, we're looking for jobs 20 hours a week. We guarantee 20 hours a week during the summer. And so I just met with Mats, who is on the rifle team from Sweden. And you know what the neat thing he did is, as kind of a bullet point of why we should hire him, he said hard work. He likes to do hard work. I thought, wow, that is really a concept to put on your – but at any rate, that's off the track. Anyway, we're looking for jobs because not only do we do it for students, but, you know, students at the local high school are eligible to come to university with faculty permission in the lower division classes. And so Juella here has hired 16-year-olds. We've done it for kids who are 16 and above. again, to encourage them to be on campus. As, you know, as a mother of kids who are now way past 16, at 16 I wanted them working. If they wanted to go to school and work, what a concept. So this is, we've put that in from 16 on. But, yes, I've been working with them specifically finding jobs.
Mm-hmm. Send them to you and you will help them.
Absolutely.
And then my other question with your, with what you're working with Mike Trega and the 28% up of the dorm rate.
Right.
Is that for a certain number of credits?
No, it's 28%. Where did I come up with that number? Well, at any rate, 14 credits, four credits of 10 is like 28%. That's what I came up with it. So I just came up with that number last year, and he bought it, and that's where the. So if you take, you don't have to take 14 credits.
Okay.
You know, you could take 11.
Can you be one of the persons taking the 6 credits and working on campus?
No.
Okay.
No. Oh, and that's a very good point. If you get a tuition award, which is for 3 credits, and you get, you can't combine that with anything else. You can't combine that with a sweet summer deal. Okay? And the, another thing we have the 3 credit tuition awards, we have 3 different categories. One for students who are 12 credits or less. Those are kids that are entering. Okay? We have them for continuing students. And this year we added graduate students. You know, every year we were taking in tuition for graduate students, but we weren't handing out tuition awards. So this year we have 20 tuition awards that we're handing to graduate students, not for thesis credits, but for actually classrooms that they have to take. Yes, ma'am.
Just a FYI for you, for helping students find jobs, if you contact Jackie Debevic in Career Services, we just had a job fair this last Friday, and she can probably give you some departments that are looking for students for summer work.
She can give me students.
No, she can give you departments.
Departments. Right, and I thank you. And, you know, one of my favorite activities, is that Mary Sue?
Yes.
My glasses are can kind of make out the M. I went around the job fair. And I said, "You looking for students? Tell me what you know. What can you make this work for you?" But that's good. I should make sure I've got them all. I'll call Jackie. Thank you. Excellent suggestion. Any other suggestions? Anything that we need to be doing or considering doing that we're not doing? Okay. Thank you so
Michelle.
Much.
This is Robert Mank from Chukchi Campus.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. Back in the 1970s and 1980s, many state universities, and I realize it's out of your domain, this is really a Board of Trustees thing, but maybe it's something that y'all could work on or could look at. Many universities at the 13th or 14th hour would charge a flat fee for full time tuition where you could take up to 18 hours at the rate of 13 or 14 hours. Have you all looked at that in order to create an economic incentive for students to complete in 4?
You know, this is Michelle. Thank you for the suggestion. We had that at UAF. I mean, I've been here since, before, when my hair was the same color as Joella's. And those of you who can't see me, my hair is white. So we did have and Gary Newman over there is waving. He's my compatriot. You know, we used to have a flat rate, and so we have discounted tuition by eliminating the out-of-state tuition, by coming up with a sweet summer deal. This is another way of almost doing a flat rate for it. One of the things, especially for the people who are speaking to or listening and communicating with us from the outlying campuses, is that the sweet summer deal is tied into the Center for Distance Education. And Summer Sessions is also offering 35 courses that are online. And I know the ethics class, which I know many students need, is being offered by audio conferencing this summer. So I would really suggest taking a look at uaf.edu/summer. We'll be glad to send all of our materials out to the various different sites if it would be of help at all, because I would love for your students to take advantage of what we have available here. Likewise, one of the things that I have totally failed at, and one of the ideas when I came on in 2003 that I wanted, was it not to be unidirectional. I was hoping that Summer Sessions was not only Fairbanks-based, but was based around the state. And although we have field-based classes, we have yet to land one on one of the campuses. So if any campus is really interested in doing it, I would love to work with them for 2013.
thank you, Michelle. It's always fun just to be near you and absorb some of your enthusiasm and look at all the beautiful publications that you put out. So thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much for asking. The dynamic duo up at the top, you guys are really in trouble, aren't you?
They say that every month. So let's just do a quick check to see if Chancellor Rogers is on the phone. It doesn't sound like it. So, Kathy, are you still with us?
I am.
Would you be willing to give your report now?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Faculty Senate is going to be handling a bunch of stuff in our meeting on Monday. And the thing, of course, that is going to be probably of most interest to staff council is we're going to be passing a resolution about the health care issue. And it has to do with the not hiring tobacco users or anyone whose spouse or dependents are tobacco users. So the Senate is going to be looking at a resolution that basically says that we are opposed to the proposed policy of not hiring a specific group of people based on higher predicted medical expenses, as this is incompatible with the operation of an open, inclusive institution, is our bottom line. So you might be hearing about that one as it comes through. We, of course, are also concerned about that huge jump in costs and where it's going to be going. There was a forum yesterday afternoon with the union, the faculty unions, to talk about the health care issue. Unfortunately, I was unable to attend it due to prior commitment. But it is something that the faculty is very concerned about, and we know that it's a place where we're, along with Staff Alliance, very concerned about where it's going, given that the rates basically erased our raises. Other things that we'll be looking at is that we have the eLab recommendation. So this was the distance science core course recommendations that came down from the eLab task force, which was a group of faculty members, three each from each MAU, who discussed what would be the best practice for trying to do distance-delivered labs to meet core course requirements. So far, we haven't had much input from the UAF community. We tried to get it out to department chairs, deans, directors, anybody teaching a core science course. We've had a couple of thoughtful comments, but really I was surprised by how little input we actually got. Other things, we're looking at electronic faculty activity reporting software, so we'll see whether or not faculty go away from that wonderful paper thing that I know all the staff just love digging through in order to get our publications and other things for assessment. So hopefully this will be easier for staff and administration to be able to pull the relevant information they need for assessment. So we'll let you know what we look at. We're down to two vendors that look like they might suit our purpose. We'll keep you posted. The other thing is we had a major discussion in terms of the course catalog, timelines, deadlines, et cetera. And at the moment, this is going to be kind of an ongoing discussion, but the key thing is to make sure that people in your unit know that basically you have to have everything received by October and a chance at getting into the catalog for the following fall. So it's over a year process, and people trying to get stuff in the last minute, it will not make the catalog. Occupational endorsements and other programs that come in, we're looking at basically adding to an addendum to the catalog. So if an occupational endorsement, which of course is meant to be quick response, comes in, there will be an addendum so that we can say, yes, this was incorporated in this catalog year, but it means that, you know, when we do the addendum, it's only additions. There can be no program changes, otherwise you get into catalog year issues. So those are going to be our prime things. We're going to also address the Complete College America charge that the president gave Faculty Alliance to look at whether or not we should be part of that program here at UAF. And the whole idea of the program is to get students to complete faster, but it's really designed for full-time first-year freshmen. And needless to say, that's not our typical student. So some of the things that they'd like to have in terms of a common core and so translation, we couldn't use native languages to fill in some of the courses. They want to have no developmental courses. They prefer to have you put that in your freshman course. A lot of faculty consider this watering down of courses. So there are going to be some interesting discussions here because the legislature and the governor would like us to sign up for this program, but we're not 100% sure it works for the students of Alaska. So we'll be looking at that, and we may come to you and say, given your experience with students, and we'll also be, of course, talking to the students, where does this program not work for Alaska so we can come up with a targeted set of here are the places where we have issues. So that's basically what we're tackling on Monday, that and voting for the new vice president of the UAS Faculty Senate. So we will know shortly who is going to be taking over for Jennifer as she takes over my place. My last meeting is May 7th, and then I'm no longer president of Faculty Senate, but I will be chair of Faculty Alliance. So are there any questions for me on what the faculty are tackling right now?
This is Robert Mackey. I don't have any questions, but there's a couple of things that I'd like to bring up to you. First of all, and this all goes to the tobacco ban. When you're, are you still writing the resolution, or has it already been written and submitted?
It's been written. The administrative committee said it is ready to go to Senate, but it may be wordsmithed on the floor. We'll have to see what's going on there.
Okay, well, just FYI, several things, because I've started creating kind of a trailblazer on this. First of all, the law is not settled on even if this can be done in a public institution. It can be done in a private institution, but in a public institution where you have property rights, it's not even clear that it's constitutional to ban people for doing illegal activity from employment, unless it impacts their direct job. The second thing is there's two parts of the Alaska Constitution I think y'all need to be aware of. First one is Section 1, Inherent Rights. It says all persons are entitled to equal rights and equal opportunities and protection under the law. The tobacco banning would seem to be against the Equal Opportunities Clause of Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution. Section 22, the right of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed. Even asking the question, do you smoke, seems to go against the privacy right of Section 22 of the Alaska Constitution. I think those are two things that y'all need to, that I would recommend that y'all would consider, because I think the legal ramifications for this, I don't think that they've done their homework. I do not believe that the lawyers have done their homework. They've already lost to Yolanda on a chip shot case, and I have no confidence in them, and these I think they've really opened up some liabilities with this that I think they're overestimating their position on.
Well, thank you for those. I'll make sure that they're included in our discussion, and also I believe I will get a chance to speak to some of the folks at Statewide on Friday during the Faculty Alliance meeting, and I'll raise these issues with them and say, you know, guys, make sure you think through what you're doing. But I know for certain that in terms of the Faculty Senate, we wanted to come down hard saying we don't think that this is appropriate for an open institution. And, you know, it's a slippery slope. If first you do tobacco, then it could be exercise, BMI, all these other things. So we really don't want to go there. So we wanted to put our foot down early and say this is not appropriate.
I agree. And my greatest fear is that the university is going to pass this to save money, and they're going to end up costing themselves more money in some sort of a lawsuit later. Even if they win, they'll lose by having this lawsuit drag out. And that's just counterproductive as heck to me. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert, and thanks, Kathy, for joining us today. We appreciate you hanging in there while we work through our agenda. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thanks.
I had a quick question for Kathy. Are you there? I'm here.
Kathy, this is Sarah Batiste at the Interior Illusions Campus. Were you guys looking for more input still from, I guess, specifically rural faculty about the science labs?
Yes, any input we can get, we would really appreciate. And the people who are on the front lines, like rural faculty, we really want to hear from.
Okay, I know I received the information about it, and I forwarded it to our science faculty. We have two here. But I can follow up and see if they'll respond and reply if they haven't.
That would be great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Sarah. Sorry to cut you off there. And any further questions for Kathy? Because we do need to move on as well. Okay. Thanks again, Kathy.
Thank you all.
And I think I'll do one quick to see if Chancellor Rogers is with us yet. No. So I'd like to get back to the unfinished business. Part of the staff council's strategic direction proposal included, well, we've moved on from that specific topic, but very much related to that is a topic that we've talked about, and that's the staff alliance representation from this body. And we've, I think now for the last two meetings, have mentioned the fact that our constitution says that the president and the vice president of staff council will represent staff, UAS staff council on staff alliance. I propose a change to say that either the vice president and president or the designees of the president can sit on staff alliance. I think that allows us flexibility, and anybody who has done both staff council, president, vice president, and staff alliance can attest to the fact that it is an unbelievable amount of work. And it's been, I've loved almost every minute of it, but it's a lot of work. And so I think this, again, just allows us to have a stronger body with responsibilities that are a little bit more spread out and kind of more realistic, I think. So that is included in our Constitution, Article 3, Section E, and it's very simple wording. It says the President and Vice President shall represent UAS Staff Council on Staff Alliance. And we'd like to change it, we'd like to propose a change to say, or the designees of the Staff Council President. We've talked about this a couple times. If there's other conversation, I know Juella has some wording that we could propose. I don't think this has to be a long conversation, but I'd like to put it on the floor.
The only question that I have is, would that designee be a member of staff council, or would it just be a staff at large?
No, it would need to be a member of staff council. Yeah, somebody who is here every single month reporting and very, I mean, there needs to be a strong connection. So this is not something that we could you know, grab somebody from the general public.
I was only asking because designee means, to me, would mean that you could just choose somebody.
Exactly.
It would mean that it would be someone from staff council.
Yeah, and that's a very good distinction. So it was. Juella probably has that in her.
Actually, one of the things we talked about was having it, for example, a past president. So, for example, PIPS could serve on Staff Alliance next year, but not the year after. The Staff Alliance's constitution reads that they recommend governance experience, and that we might stiffen that language up a little bit. But we could make it more specific if you so wish. One of the things that was talked about at the Staff Alliance level, this came out of Staff Alliance when we looked at the turnover every year that Staff Alliance experiences with its officers. We were looking at ways to shrink that turnover, to lessen the impacts of the turnover, because each September, we have to go to the board and be prepared to talk about the compensation increase. While the new members of Alliance have only been on, in their role for a month, not even that in some cases. So the point when this came out of Alliance was, we need to find a way to open up our membership so that we can keep people on here longer. So one of the conversations was about it can be current officers or past officers of the local council. So they can designate a past officer. And so we can have that language, say a past officer or current representative of staff council. If that's more palatable, but I will say at the retreat last week, one group, the Staff Alliance represents four different local councils. One has passed an amendment, changing their constitution has begun the process, and the other two are working on that. They're in, they're about to take the first step. So.
Yeah, I am. But come on.
So are there any questions about this? And if not, I might ask Juella to read the wording that she has, and then if somebody would like to make a motion to bring it to the floor. Or maybe the other way around.
So we had suggested wording, UAF Staff Council moves to amend its Constitution, Article 3, Section E, its bylaws, Article 4, Section A, 1J, and Article 4, Section B, 1C, to add, in quotes, or their designee, but we can change that to see, so where it states Staff Council's President and Vice President will serve as representatives. We can say Staff Council's President, Vice President, past officers or current representatives as designated by the officers may serve on as Staff Alliance representative. This motion serves as first reading of this amendment. If passed, we'll move to the second reading in, at our April meeting.
Gary, did you have a
Well, we don't actually have the motion for us
right.
yet. But normally we're, in fact, it was, you wanted to have motions in writing, and I think that would be appropriate, for particularly for something of this, and then I would expect that it would go to EMR, be referred to them for doing whatever EMR does, which is look at how it fits into the whole picture. The one complicating factor for me is what we're doing with representation overall is part of what we've already sent over to EMR earlier today. So I'm wondering if it's just maybe a little more, or could just be folded into what they're already doing. I don't know. Somehow it just seems like things are, it adds something a little out of sync.
Yeah, and I apologize if that's the way people are feeling. I was trying to keep them separate as because we've talked about them separately. So I was trying to keep them simple and compact. So I would suggest, if people are comfortable, making a motion and bring this forward, and then we could ask EMR to look at the whole package together, if that would be acceptable.
Yeah, this is Gary Bender. I would move that we take that approach.
I would second.
So, Gary, were you making the motion to bring this to a vote to the floor right now?
At least a motion to whether or not we need to move it on so that it can actually get into EMR and EMR can begin to work with it.
Okay. And John, you seconded that?
I think I would support rolling it into the existing changes.
And I think that's what Gary was saying too.
Same thing.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so we have a motion on the floor to take the current wording regarding the Staff Alliance representation and move that on to the EMR with the package that we did earlier. And that's what's on the floor right now.
I apologize. Does that mean that when it comes back for a reading, those constitutional changes will be one vote? So we'd be voting on both changes at the same time. So if you vote no to one of them, you're going to have to vote no to both, or yes to one, yes to both. Would that be correct?
May I comment?
Yes.
I think what we're doing is just asking EMR to draw up the changes as a package, and I think it's going to come back to this body for constructive criticism and moving things around.
Right, but does that mean that the end result will be reading the changes as one, so it'll be one vote for both changes?
I think you can, at the time, you can move to have them as separate votes.
Okay, so is everybody clear on what we're doing? We'll send both of these things to EMR. They'll come back, and we can vote on them separately once EMR has had a chance to massage if you desire. Okay, I'm seeing some nods, so I'm getting getting the general feeling that people are understanding. I'm sorry if I made this more complicated than it should be. So at this point, I would like to take a vote to move this to EMR. Let's do the same thing we did before. Everybody in favor in the room, please raise your hand. And if people could online, why don't I just call? I think I have the list of people who are online. I'll just do a quick roll call, and you can say aye if you are in favor of this. Robert?
I'm sorry. I had to miss part of it, so I'm going to abstain from the vote at this time.
Okay. Walker?
Aye.
Gary?
Aye.
Debbie?
Aye.
Jennifer?
Aye.
Deb Jepson?
Aye.
Kayla?
Aye.
Heather?
Aye.
Evelyn?
Aye.
Sarah?
Aye.
Have I missed anybody online?
This is Brittany.
I'd like to change my vote to aye. If everybody's for it, I'm going to go ahead with the crowd.
Robert and Britton?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I say aye as well.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else online? And any opposed in the room? And any opposed online? Okay, thank you. This will be forwarded to EMR. Thank you. I'd like to take a very quick break, a 3-minute break, get up, stretch your legs, do what you need to do, and then we will come back and move on. Okay, we're going to get started because we do have a full agenda, and I've been so proud about trying to get us out on time every time. So if everybody could take their seats again. We have we're going to start this section of the agenda with two guest speakers. Our first is going to be Ashley Monroe, who has been doing a phenomenal job of organizing our Staff Appreciation Day, immense amount of work. And I can't say how appreciative I am of Ashley taking on this role. I know she's working with Maria too, but I've been in contact with Ashley a lot, and I'm just so happy that she's doing this for us. So she's going to talk a little bit about Staff Appreciation Day and ask for your help, and I'd like everybody to sign up for some piece of Appreciation Day.
Well, for Staff Appreciation Day, we are in need of quite a few volunteers, starting pretty much all day. And what I'm going to do is pass around the beautiful color schedule that we have and just do some explaining while we're at it. We will need some volunteers in the morning for breakfast, just to kind of round up. Breakfast in the morning is going to be here in the Wood Center. Then we'll have the Chancellor's Welcome, which we won't need too many volunteers for. We will need some volunteers to help run tables for the Frisbee Golf Tournament, the Bowling Tournament, and the Photo Scavenger Hunt. Also on here are some, I don't know what to call them, outline sessions and permanent markers, so they hopefully stand out a little bit. Those are the sessions that we believe can be broadcast out to rural sites via eLive, but we need at least one volunteer for each of those outline sessions to kind of run it and be the person in charge. We will contact you if you do sign up. Just, if you're interested in that particular session and want to help, just go ahead and write your name in the box, and we will contact you with a training opportunity so that you can learn how to set up eLive and be the person responsible for that. We will also help you get the equipment together as well. There are some other sessions on here that are not outlined, and those would be like there's a yoga session, there's some walking tours, things like that probably can't be eLive. The yoga and Zumba could be a possibility if you're really interested in signing up for those. Go ahead and put your name down, and we'll contact the instructor and see if we can work something out to get those out to the people who can't attend the event in Fairbanks. If you do sign up for a session, we will hold a space for you. So a lot of these sessions fill up very quickly, and if you want to guarantee a space, signing up will be the best way to do that. If you're interested in just volunteering for maybe longevity awards or for the ice cream social or anything else, you could just go ahead and put your name on the back and what you're interested in. And Katrina Paul has actually volunteered to be the volunteer coordinator for the day, and she will be in contact with you to let you know where you need to go and when. So I will go ahead and start this around the room, and we'll find out a way how to get it to people who are not here but online, and I'll wait. I'll be here until it makes it around the room.
Are there any questions?
Ashley, this is Robert Mackey.
Hi, Robert.
Is it too late to submit, it sounds like it is, to submit program ideas, because I've been traveling and I just haven't had time to submit anything?
We right now have 3 open sessions, and those are represented, for those of you in the room, by the pink spots We do have two possibilities. We just don't have them lined up yet. So there is a possibility for one open session. It is pretty time specific based off of how many rooms are available and so on. But I can send those to you.
Okay. And last year when I participated, I was able to get travel. Do you know offhand if that would be able to be done this year, or would I have to do it distance from here in Kotzebue?
We're looking into that right now to see whether or not funds will be available, and I'll be getting in touch with those of you. This is the whole thing.
Okay, that's fine. And I'll remind you via email, and I'll try to get something together before the end of the day today and send it to you.
I'm sorry, isn't that a face-to-face meeting the day before or day after? So if you were coming in for that. Okay.
We'll also need a lot of volunteers the night before, probably starting at about 3 o'clock, to bring over the longevity wards and get them set up. I'm actually not going to be here that week, and so I know Maria would appreciate any assistance that can be given by staff now.
If I present, I'll be happy to volunteer when I'm not presenting, like I did last year.
Actually, when is it going out to sign up for sessions? Actually, as soon as we get room numbers lined up, we're going to send it to our registration person. I believe Walker is helping with that. And we'll have registration open hopefully mid-April.
Thank you.
Any final questions for Ashley while the list is going around the room? Okay. Ashley, thank you. Don't leave without your list. Okay, we're going to move on, and it's my pleasure to introduce Mae Marsh, who is our new Director of Diversity and Equal Opportunity Office. I think Mae's been on the job for almost a month, and Joel and I have had a chance to meet with her very briefly and are really looking forward to getting to know her better. We've heard of lots of good plans that she's working on, and I will give the microphone to Mae, so thank you.
I just want to come by and introduce myself. I have 12 years experience in this field. I come to you with a strong federal background in employment discrimination. And now I'm trying to figure out exactly how to apply that here, how to apply it also to the students and their issues. I have experience. I worked here in Alaska for 20 years, went on an adventure, went overseas, and then I come to you from Virginia, where I was the Deputy Director of EEO for the Defense Contract Management Agency. So it's good to be back in Alaska. And I thought I'd tell you a little bit about how I work. In my role here at the university, I am a neutral party. That means that I'm not going to represent management and I'm not going to represent employees. I'm an advocate for a process. So if someone files a complaint, I will ensure that they get due process. I will ensure that any decisions that are made, that they know their rights and their responsibilities, and any decisions that are made are going to be in compliance with guidance and with the law. That being said, I do process complaints, but that's not my favorite thing to do. I would much rather look at early resolution and what we can put in place institutionally to resolve things at an early level to keep our employers happier and more productive. So I'm interested in partnering and working with anybody in that endeavor. So thank you for the welcome, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Mae. Are there any questions for Mae? Gary?
Hi, thank you, and welcome. One of the challenges in dealing with process, and particularly when we find something broken, is essentially the issue that brought it up is already grandfathered, so there's no process to deal with, so suddenly we realize we need a process. So in those cases, how does perhaps common sense still maybe part of the process of resolving a particular issue for which there is no process or an inadequate process to resolve the problem. Does that make sense?
I don't know. I'm following you.
Okay.
I know that there's a process in place for complaints if someone believes they're being discriminated against. and so I'm not sure I'm following you.
Well, in personnel actions, I've seen and to some degree I've experienced where a particular situation isn't really addressed by the process. You know, for one reason, it's one of these areas nobody anticipated. And so, do you feel like you have the flexibility to find ways through those issues, or is that not part of what you see as something that is under your purview?
Give me an example.
An employee has an issue with a supervisor, and somehow the process that's established doesn't really resolve the issue. The process is established for following through with grievance or whatever, reprimands, however, all those different things. It really doesn't resolve the issue. And so the question is, do you feel like you have the flexibility to go in and find a solution for that particular situation, or have to do it only within the confines of whatever processes already exist?
Are we talking more like mediation?
A mediation would be an example, yeah.
Well, that's part of a process that's established, right?
It's kind of in its infancy, I think.
I think we have to look at one aspect of May's position that somewhat she has to fit between the lines, and that is these are complaints regarding the protected classes. This isn't a complaint between an employee and a supervisor. Wouldn't necessarily come to her. It would go to HR unless, for example, the employee feels they're being discriminated because of their age, race, or something like that. So that there's some limit there in her role in grievances, which is a topic she and I have already discussed, my concern with the grievance process. And so I think in your question, she does have, one, constraints on what she can work in, that she has to work within, and how she can, what she has to do in resolving those complaints.
Okay, I thought somewhere is in the other duties and assigns, but that's okay.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, one of the things I've struggled with here is I'm trying to get definite guidance on the lanes. You know, what lane is HR in, what lane am I in, what lane is Don Foley's office in, you know, to make sure that I understand what my role and responsibilities are here. Now, if an employee believes that something is happening to them based on their race, color, national origin, sex, disability, age, religion, genetic information, pregnancy, all of those what we call protected categories. So there's something under the law that gives them that protection. Those are the types of things that come to me. If it's an issue, if it's a conflict, those types of issues would go to HR because they're not, it's not a violation of one of the civil rights laws.
I just, part of my confusion is perhaps because your predecessor was dealing a lot with mediations and such like that, and so that may be something that over time she took on as extra roles.
Well,
CEO role.
Yeah, this is another thing that I've looked at is, you know, trying to set up maybe a clearinghouse for the conflicts, for the things that go on. And however that's established, you know, because that's been the model that I'm used to, is however that's established, then that clearinghouse would determine what lane it goes into for resolution.
And I would add, as a part of the group that worked with Erlina to create the mediation program, our specific intent was to keep it separate from HR. And because Erlina was a champion, it fell within her office. And so in that case, you're right. I mean, you know, HR might refer to a situation they think is mediable to her, to May. But keep in mind, mediation doesn't cover performance issues.
And the other thing is, you know, mediation is part of the process for a complaint. You know, it's one of the requirements is that you can offer mediation rather than going through a litigation.
And I believe mediation can also be initiated by the employee, not necessarily through HR. So this is something that a supervisor or an employee, if they had an issue with a supervisor, can initiate that process of mediation completely outside of HR. And I think you're right, Gary, in some respects there's a lot of work to be done in mediation, and I think that's on the table.
Good questions. Any other questions for May?
Well, this is Jennifer, and I had an it may not go directly to May, but it falls right into kind of what we're talking about. I had an employee come to me, and they told me that it was hard for them to find any type of information on our website, HR, UAF, anything to do with a grievance. And again, but they found that other universities had a clear detailed avenue or plan. It's like a grievance plan or what steps you should take before it got to grievance or anything like that, clearly labeled on their website. And so that if you ever had any questions like that, you could just go to the website without having to call HR. And they asked me to bring that up at the meeting and find out if maybe we can we could find why they felt the university was kind of purposely not putting a grievance policy or a grievance procedures online. I know you can find them on the Board of Regents policies and regulations, but without going there, it would be nice to have them somewhere else. So I just told that person I would bring it up, and hopefully somebody might be able to shed a little bit more light on that for us as a group. Thanks.
Thank you, Jennifer. This is Joella. I have long held that the grievance process is inherently unfair to staff, and I actually came across, in fact, I think it was Erlina that gave it to me, was a booklet entitled the UA Grievance Handbook, and it was for staff, and it was from the 70s. They have since obviously done away with that, and I believe that the only information available to staff is in Board of Regents policy and regulations. I think there's a problem with that, and I would certainly advocate and encourage this group to. This is an MAU specific issue, I think. Though if I don't know if UA Anchorage or UA Southeast has a better and more transparent process, honestly, but I would say here and maybe system wide, we should demand that. We should demand a handbook that tells us step by step the grievance process, how you get into it, and what your rights are, and so on. I'm absolutely an advocate of that, and would encourage staff affairs, if it had a chair, to take on that task and push it forward.
Thanks.
I just want to reiterate the importance of this. When I was non-retained, I couldn't get anybody from HR to return a phone call to me to address what my rights were or what the grievance process was, which I later found out there was none at that time. So this has been a problem that at least I'm very familiar with and have experienced myself, and just want to reiterate that. I also have a question. And do you consider your job to be more proactive, or do you consider your job to be more reactive?
Well, the policy says I have to have both, that I have to be reactive when there's a complaint and I have to be proactive at the same time. So it depends on how many complaints I got sitting on my desk that I'm trying to process. My natural instinct.
But you are open. If somebody feels like there is a policy issue to where there might be a discriminatory issue, or if there is a an action for which somebody is not comfortable, they are free to contact you, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think one of the things that I've struggled with is I'm trying to get a handle on what are the avenues of redress, not just to the employees but also to the students, because I think we need some publication on exactly what they are so people are informed of their rights and, you know, and can access those.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Just a comment to add what Joel had said. Yeah, that information is in the Board of Regents, but I think you either have to be or have an attorney to actually get through the process and the way it's structured. And so the average employee looks at a confused bundle of mess that will get them at just about every turn.
In your end note, to clarify, Robert, your comment about Yana Taylor, who's brought the lawsuit against the university on non-retention, it's actually before the state Supreme Court tomorrow. She won her case in the lower court and now defends tomorrow at the state Supreme Court, which I'm anxiously waiting to hear how they decide.
I wish her all the luck in the world.
Thank you, everybody, and May, thank you for being here, and we're looking forward to working with you through the years. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, with that, we'll take a quick check to see if Chancellor Rogers is with us. And seeing that he is not, we're going to move on to 8, new business. I'm just going to quickly go through A. Staff Council President and Vice President seats are, the election will be in May. Please think about running for either President or Vice President seat. I've sure learned a lot being in this position, and probably 95% of the time very, very much enjoyed it. There have been a few moments where I felt a little bit overwhelmed, but it's been a great learning experience for me, and just a role that I wouldn't give up this year. I will give up next year. So, think about if you're interested in running, I'd be happy to talk to you, as with Juella, and kind of go over some of the specifics. So if you have any questions, just wanted to remind people that the elections will be in May, so please think about running. Any questions about that? Okay. We're going to move on to the healthcare update. The last two pieces of the agenda are the healthcare update and then the tuition waiver update. So I've asked Juella if she would lead the discussion on the healthcare update, because she led the discussion at the staff alliance level, and I will pass it to Juella, because this is a topic that is imminent and important.
Wow. So what do you think? Don't all speak at once.
I'm in a job.
Yeah.
No, retire. It's cheaper.
There you go. I think all of us, certainly Pips and I, and every member of Alliance, has certainly heard from our constituents in the last week or two. That you all received a letter March 19 from Donald Smith, the interim chief HRO, on the FY13 health plan costs. I was stunned. I was stunned. I have to say that. Though they did give us some warning. So in the area of the health, our health care benefit, we have some things, the different things going on here. I, early in the fall, asked President Gamble to start a task force that would not look at our current system as how do we fix this, but look at just a completely fresh look at other working systems, other systems in the state with statewide state of Alaska employees or other large employers in the state, and so on. We had a discussion with Cindy West, who's a representative of I think it's United Academics. Yes, and they're who is the, one of the faculty unions. They are working to do something very similar to this. They're going to put together an effort. The key here is, though, and this is something that you need to, in the information that you received, it was implied, if not outright stated, that JHCC made these decisions. You need to know it is not JHCC's decision. It is the administration's decision. JHCC offers input on these changes, premiums, et cetera, but the administration, including Donald Smith and President Gamble, make the decisions, no one else. They certainly get input from our chancellors. They get input and reaction from the regents, et cetera, but they make the decision. The other thing I also want to make you aware of is all of our vendors, all of our contracts are up for review in the coming year with all the vendors, with our dental plan, our vision, WIN, et cetera. They're all up for review in the coming year, which means we really need to be paying attention to these contracts that we're getting and the work of the staff healthcare committee and the joint healthcare committee even more important. Because these are prime opportunities to make change. So what I'm going to ask you to do today is, in no uncertain terms, demand that your president take the Staff Alliance request for a task force. Truly, as was just mentioned to me a little bit ago, we can't get them to the table to discuss these. New ideas, new solutions. They haven't been open necessarily to new ideas and new ways of looking at this challenge of our ever increasing healthcare costs. I do want to point out that when you get an opportunity, if you know a local legislator, talk to them. Especially our rural employees, if you know a local legislator, talk to them. Tell them about this burden. Tell them in a letter President Gamble wrote to the legislature on the state of the university when he delivered the budget request. He talked about a $7 million cost shift. Avoidance, yes, he called, I'm sorry, a cost avoidance. Well, in fact, it was a shift, $7 million from the university to the university employees. In the form of our deductibles and those changes that came last July 1 saved the university $7 million and cost us $7 million. So, certainly the premiums are a focus, but there are other things on the healthcare horizon, the tobacco-free hiring policy. I've already spoken to Donald Smith. He came. He attended the Staff Alliance business meeting on Friday morning, and I'm trying to think of the right way to put this. The administration's focus is on the bottom line. I will say this without hesitation. Their focus is on saving them money. It's not on recognizing the critical role that staff alongside faculty serve in making this a great university for our students. I have to say that quite clearly, and I think it's our role today to say we've had enough. We need to make this stop. So one of the things that we're doing is, in particular for the tobacco-free, one of the things that Donald brought is we've come to you and we've discussed. First, we discussed the surcharge, and you didn't like it, so we changed that and talked about tobacco-free hiring. Let's tell them. One of the ideas that came out of Staff Alliance is we'd like to put SurveyMonkey survey of the three options, because one of the things that we're hearing a lot about is the tobacco-free campus. So what I'd like to do is we're going to send you out a link, and it's going to let you go to a web page, and you're going to say which campus or which MAU you're with, and it's going to say which would you prefer in order of priority, a tobacco surcharge, a tobacco-free campus, or a tobacco-free hiring policy. The thing that you need to keep in mind, and this is another side, kind of a sidebar, the point of this tobacco effort was to save money. Was to reduce costs. So a tobacco-free campus won't necessarily do that. The other thing to keep in mind, and we've all heard this, I can't even tell you how many times I've heard this, in reaction to all of these proposed changes and the premiums, what's next? What will they do next? The next it'll be BMI. The next they'll go after obesity. Well, I know one thing that is next, and this is my role as a devil's advocate to you. I know one thing that's next. In July 1, my paycheck goes down. July 1, 2013, it goes down again. And 2014, it goes down again. So when you're looking at this, you have to keep an open mind to the reality that no change certainly means a real change in your paycheck. So while you might not approve of the tobacco-free hiring policy, I encourage you to look at the repercussions. To keep in all of your decisions, keep all the repercussions in mind that everything's costing us money as it is, and that money is going up and up. And in 2013, we take over another percentage of the total cost. Right now, as you noted, it's 83.17. It goes to 82.18, where staff bear another percentage of total cost, and then again the following year, and so on. So I know I'm kind of ranting and raving here, but the first thing you need to do is say we've had enough, if, unless, of course, that you make enough money that you can bear this cost burden. And then at the alliance level, we're pushing for it. Trust me, at the JHCC level, they're pushing for change, and at the union, with the unions, individual unions. If with our unified voice, with us all sending emails to our legislators, to the president, to the Board of Regents, to our chancellor, saying we've had enough, this is no longer acceptable, you have to make real change here, you have to show vision, then maybe they'll make the step and they'll meet us in the discussions. But until then, I'm not seeing any inclination on the administration's part to do that. I'll stop. Richard?
Well, I'd just like to reinforce what you said. But, you know, I went to one of the SAA meetings, and he emphasized that he really didn't need anyone's permission to do anything.
Right.
That their role was to save the university money, and this is going to do it.
I'm sorry, this is Robert Mackey. He's cutting in and out.
Yeah, can you repeat what he said?
So go ahead if you want to try louder.
I just wanted to agree with what Joella said, and I attended a recent SAA meeting, and the president sort of made a point that he really didn't need anyone's permission to do this. Is that anything with the board is just for their information, but he wasn't asking permission.
And I'll, to add to that, I will tell you that this administration is has a different perception of shared governance. As you, I hope you all realize, under Board of Regents Policy 0301, the regents have said that there will be a governance mechanism in place that the president works with staff governance, he works with faculty governance, he works with the students to make decisions about the direction of the university. And that, I believe, I had the pleasure of working in governance under Mark Hamilton, and he had his moments, but he was a visionary leader. This administration does not see governance the same way. I'll say that as well.
I apologize when I cut in. There is a beeping that's been going on for some time. I don't know if it's someone's device or if there's something, but it's like the tick-tocking of a clock. It's getting a little crazy to me.
Sorry, we can't.
I do have a couple of things about the healthcare, but the one thing that I would ask, I guess, after your comment about his attitude in general about the governance, is if that's his general attitude about the governance, then does this organization as a whole really stand a chance in trying to represent the staff with that attitude that he doesn't need any input from us, that he can do what he wants to do?
I guarantee you that if 250 of you show up at the Board of Regents meeting and they receive a comparable number of emails, the Board of Regents will tell them to pay attention. I guarantee you that if the legislature starts talking to the regents and to the president about, we're getting a lot of voter unhappiness about the cost shifting, they'll start thinking about this. Yes.
And would it be possible to get a copy of the letter for his cost shifting letter?
Certainly, I have that.
I would definitely like a copy of that. Mm-hmm. As far as the health care, my constituents, by no stretch of the imagination, are happy, and I've received several messages, which I have given you and Tim comments regarding that. But I also noticed on some of the JHCC information that they're talking about going away from the $500 and $750 plan to just a plain high deductible, high pay plan,
mm-hmm.
Which concerns me as an individual and will concern my constituents. And when I look at that, they noted in there that there's 197 that are on the 500 plan and over 2,500 that are on the 750 plan, and there's only 1,300 on the high pay plan. And it sounds like that they're just talking about moving in that direction, and I'm just curious as to are we really going to have a voice in that, because there's more that are on the 500 and 750 plan than on the other plan.
Well, the JHCC, certainly the JHCC takes input on that, and if that's if you want to bring forward a motion that makes that clear to Staff Alliance, as Staff Healthcare Committee will take a position on it as well. I mean, I'm sure that every significant change like that will be reviewed in SHCC and at JHCC. Now, again, you know, they don't have to listen to JHCC. But, you know, unless you say, no, don't do this, you know, they won't think twice.
And as far as saving money, one of my constituents brought up a point today. For as much as we put into the WIN program, has anybody looked into the cost savings of taking the money that goes into the WIN program and actually opening up the SRC to staff?
I will say that for as long as I've been involved in governance and WIN has existed, it's been an irritant.
Yes.
And for you could count on annually practically either JHCC or SHCC saying, what is our return on investment in WIN? I think it's just I would say possibly with a change in who's overseeing the plan, though I'm not confident of that. My company is a big fan of it, and so he defended it. And you know, there's some discussion, disagreement about how many years you have to make an investment in wellness before it shows up in decreased costs and so on. So you can certainly, this body can take specific positions on components of the healthcare and then pass that on. I can tell you this, that I'm confident they know that WIN is not necessarily a popular program.
This is Debbie Gonzalez. I just wanted to make one comment on this. It seems like the SRC is the end-all, be-all for, you know, staff exercise, and it is the student rec center, and we have to keep remembering that they funded it and they built it. Maybe something needs to be looked at on the staff part for, you know, something that would meet staff needs as well, but I just kind of wanted to point that out again.
I note that, and I do respect that. At the same time, there are a lot of staff that do take classes that are students. And
I agree. I'd be in the devil's advocate. Just
right.
Wanted to.
But it's bothersome to me personally. I'm not speaking for my constituents on this one. It's bothersome to me personally that they can pick and choose when I'm a staff and when I'm a student.
Right. Right.
But
no.
If I take classes, I have to pay student fees. But if I want to go down to use the SRC, I can't use the SRC unless I'm a member of it.
Right. No.
So that's irritant for me personally.
No, I agree. I just was being the devil's advocate.
This is Heather Levengood, and I had brought up about the SRC being supplemented by the WIN for Alaska program, which, by the way, it was on the grapevine that it brings for WIN for Alaska. We're currently paying out, and this is from Erica Van Flyn, a director of benefits of statewide, $1,730,400 per year is what goes for WIN for Alaska. But they cannot put it towards the SRC because the University of Alaska Anchorage and also Juneau, the Southeast, does not have any comparable programs, is what they said, or any type of comparable facilities. So UAF would be the only campus that would benefit from that, and so they can't just pull money out for UAF only. And that was the answer that I got for that. This is a little FYI.
You know, just 1 second. I know that we could consume hours with this discussion, and what we really want to do is, for example, get your input on the tobacco piece, direction from you on, you know, making the administration known about how you feel about this, but also then input if there is, for example, a task force of faculty and staff that looks at it. They will, of course, open up a website or a mechanism for you to provide input and suggestions and issues and concerns about the current health plan and et cetera. So I'm not trying to discourage discussion today, but there will be mechanisms for input. I'm suggesting that you take some action in the limited amount of time that we have left today, and then I'll open it up.
This is Kayla Hansen. A couple of things. First of all, I know I'm going to date myself here, but I was one of the students that voted for the SRC, and now that I'm staff, and even I think my student self would agree that the goal is for an overall healthier campus. And I think if we were to work with the student council body to discuss this issue, I'm sure they'd think about it too, because we're not looking at just how are we taking care of one, it's how we are taking care of all of us.
Secondly, even though I was a student voting for that SRC, I was also I graduated from UAA. Now, with that said, UAA does have those facilities, and they just got a lot of money to build more facilities. So that can't be an argument. We're looking at what we can do to make us all a healthier campus. That's students, that's staff, that's faculty. Overall wellness should not be, the issue. We want that for everybody. So as that said, that's my take on it.
This is Robert Mackey. When we received the letters this week about, or last week, about the increases in the increase in the medical insurance, I received a great deal of interest in governance from my peers, and how this happened. And I explained it to them, and they understand, but they're not happy. Out of our 7 employees, 2 are intending to opt out. They have other options. I really expect from the comments I've heard, not just from my campus, but from other rural campuses, we're about to see a real problem retaining and recruiting people to our rural campuses, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was the main campuses. They've really opened a Pandora's box here, and I haven't seen people this angry in a long time. And I'm not talking about at a university. I'm talking about period at any place I've worked. And I think the university is on the precipice of a real economic catastrophe at having to figure out how to retain and recruit new people to this university facing these benefits. You can get the same job in state government and pay half as much as you do to insure yourself with the University of Alaska, as you can insure your entire family with the GGU plan, similar plan, 500 plan, at the university, or sorry, at the state level. That inequity is going to drive people out in droves, and if the university does not recognize that, they're about to have a very rude awakening, and they're going to find themselves in a real crisis.
Thank you, Robert. John?
Comment on the tobacco issue. I know Jennifer and I duplicated, mainly Jennifer, duplicated the survey that Walker put out. And realistically, our unit, we had approximately a 52% response rate from our unit, overwhelmingly in favor of the tobacco-free campus over the other items. So
those of you that have gone and done these individual surveys, will you please share those, the results of those, with Pips and I and Nicole, and we will put out another call, but we still need to all the numbers that we can work with. I encourage all of you to share your specific examples. When you're emailing the Board of Regents and when you're emailing a legislator or the president, give them your specific examples that I make this amount of money, I've been here 10 years, and in the last 3 years my paycheck's gone down. Give them specifics. Don't just rant at them. Give them as much information as you can. Make it real for them. When you make as much money as they do and you're as high up on the pyramid as they are, they can be a little desensitized unless you make it real. They can be desensitized to ranting. Gary.
Thank you.
I have a quick question. This is Sarah
online.
That you had said something about there possibly being a SurveyMonkey in relation to the tobacco issues. Is there currently one that we can send out?
No, it's my intent to build it in the next day or two and get it out to all staff council to distribute.
Okay.
I'm sorry for those online. We have a gentleman here that wants to make a statement, and then we'll specifically ask for online input.
Sorry about that. Thank you.
No worries.
Okay, thank you. Just a few things. I did have a chance to attend Melanie Arthur's presentation yesterday that was mostly geared toward the faculty, but I got the chance to see it from the staff perspective. And she's here today in case you had any questions. She did pass out a PowerPoint with her permission. I would share it with you folks, too. One of the things I became aware of is that as this last go-round where the deductibles were raised, and they made a big point that the fact that they weren't raising the premiums, those deductibles apparently don't, and the amount that we pay into those don't go into the 83.17 percent. So, in fact, if we just cost shifted 10% of our costs onto ourselves through that the increased out of pocket and deductibles, that's not reflected in their 83.17. To me, that's a big cost shift to us that's not being recognized. The other couple of things that I've noticed is, excuse me, I'm slightly distracted here. Is that when we're looking at supposedly saving money, and I look at some of the actuarial responses on the large cost events that are supposedly driving a lot of the healthcare cost increases, and they're actually been going down from what I read recently. And then I'm looking at people shifting their plans to the cheaper plans in terms of the premiums. And the people that are doing that by and large, or that are shifting off entirely, tend to be the healthier people because they think they can get away with it. Therefore, it's end up costing the plan more. So in essence, the concept of saving money, if you're saying that's what the administration is looking at, is not accomplishing even their stated purposes. So there's a little bit of a logic here that I just really, truly don't understand. The concept of joining with GGU or with the state of Alaska, I think that's something that needs to be explored. We are a separate entity statewide from the rest of state of Alaska, but I don't think there's anything precluding us from looking at that. There's four union contracts out that are basically, I think, through this next year, will basically has the JHCC model where they don't actually negotiate the health care separately. And after that point, then there's some more stuff that can be put on the table. And I guess, I mean, there's a lot more detail in options that are available to us. You guys had a presentation with patient care that would, for I think $2 per employee per month, they would actually go and help you find the most economical and quality-based care compared to the 30-40% premium we pay for major events here in Alaska, surgeries and such like that. Those are on the back burner now because they're busy doing all these other RFPs for our other providers. It seems like there's been a little bit of lack of attention and kind of lack of concern. We got this pot of money, we're willing to give you this pot of money, and we're not willing to give you any more, and we're really not willing to go any further and make an effort to go beyond that. And maybe it's a different in perspective between the two presidents, as Juala was speaking, and I just like to reinforce that the university isn't a railroad. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks, everybody. Carolyn, I'd like to hear what you want to say. We are going to wrap this up in the next couple minutes, so think about whether you would like to take a course of action and what that might be. So, Carolyn, go ahead, and then we'll move on to the next.
I just wanted to state that I've had a lot of reaction from my constituents since this letter came out, and actually since it became known, which was several days before the letter came out. And most of them are wanting to know why they weren't informed that this was going to happen. And I know last fall, or actually last summer, when the new plan came out, we were told at that time that they weren't going to touch it for FY13, but the rates probably would go up some. And since then, we haven't heard anything. And then suddenly we get this letter, and it's more than some. And I think we need to send out some kind of a letter to all staff and faculty as far as, you know, what kind of proposals were put out. What did JHCC actually propose? What was their recommendation? And why the staff was not informed that this was a possibility?
So we related to that, Alliance last week, we decided that it was time to truly take governance efforts to the individual staff employee. So we're putting together a newsletter, a kind of approach that explains some inaccuracies, that talks about JHCC and its role, gives information on the healthcare benefit, it would give information on the tuition waiver benefit and so on. And it's intended, it will come from Alliance, but it's intended to go to every employee of the university. And so each of us is committed to pushing it out hard at the local level. And it's really an update on governance, where we are, why, you know, how we're feeling about all of this, and what's happened, you know, and so on. So, I mean, that's what I'm talking, what I'm in response to your concern, and we'll refer people to specific web pages that are supposed to have that documentation on them about how did we get where we are.
Hey, Joella, this is Jen Elharden Seward, and I went through, you know, the whole document for the last staff council meeting and noticed that a lot of the concerns employees were having with staff council and governance is that the communication via email is inefficient. It's not up to par. If we send out all this documentation to people via email, they're just going to delete it, and then they're going to a year later say they never got the information. They never got the information. So I know funding is a big thing, but I noticed that people really got slammed with this documentation two ways. They got their emails a few weeks ago, and then they got the letter from HR saying your rates are going to be increased. And I'd like to know how those people got those things. If they got them the main point when they got their mail, and you know, from the post office or something, maybe that's a way we start communicating. We need to start having more funding to actually send things out via mail after we send an email, because I'm finding that this email thing has not worked over the last few years. So if we want to get a point across, we need to find a different avenue.
Just a point to build on that. In my opinion, we've only scratched the surface. There's going to be a sizable amount of people that don't even realize this is happening until open enrollment happens and they actually have to make the choice.
Then they're burying their heads in the sand. Sorry, but
I agree, but I'm just saying that's the reality that I see coming.
And I don't know why, if it was sent to them on paper, they'd pay any more attention to it than I don't know. It is frustrating, the whole communicating and people denying that they're aware of things. But that's their own choice to a certain degree, and it goes back to how do you get people interested in, you know, staff council and what happens to staff?
I appreciate the input on recommending something in hard copy in the PO box versus the versus an email. And I think what we need to look at, it's true that we do have at the local level a very limited budget, and certainly our budget is being eyed at the Alliance level as well. So what we need to do is get imaginative in how we do this. And I think that's something that maybe John and I can sit down and come up with some ideas to get this our governance, staff governance newsletter out to everyone, and to try to we have to communicate. And you're right, Deb, that lots of people stick their head in the sand. Apathy among staff has made me crazy in my time at governance. You don't get their attention until they open their paycheck the first or second pay period in July. So I appreciate the input, and we'll go from there, but I want to repeat Pips's urging that we make a statement and take a position, or we table this for now because we do have to move on.
This is Deb Jepson. I'd like to say something. We felt the same type of issues when I was working for the state, and I was affiliated with a union. And one of the most effective tools that we had was using a picture of a local person that was in a postcard format that had very bulleted issues on it. If you have a picture of somebody that is recognizable, that maybe has worked on campus for a long time, you can flip the card over and they'd just be bullets of issues that are of importance. You're going to have somebody more likely to read that than some type of large document.
Yeah, this is Gary Binder. I have a question, I guess, about the process by which people found out. I mean, to me, it was a little bit disingenuous to find out via, essentially the newsminer the evening after, I guess, the SAA folks became aware of it. I mean, did the university have some other notification process?
No. That was primarily a timing issue. JHCC, in the first half of this month, there have been multiple JHCC meetings where the final numbers were brought to them by the administration. JHCC, gave their input on the numbers, but basically, the administration said, here are the coming premiums, the coming fiscal year's premiums. And they shared that with JHCC, who had a particularly one of the individuals forwarded it out to their union members, because keep in mind, JHCC are union reps, and the statewide administration and two staff seats. And that was forwarded on by one of the union members to their connection at the newsminer. That's kind of how it moved quickly from JHCC to union to the newsminer. I'm not sure the SAA component. SAA, for those of you that aren't sure, they are the statewide administration assembly. They are our comparable council for statewide employees.
This is Debbie again. I guess I have a question too. How many people have actually gone out and looked at the FAQs that they put out related to the letter? To me, it seemed, of course, I didn't spend a huge amount of time with it, that they did a relatively decent job of explaining what transpired. That information, maybe I'm wrong on this, but it seems like it's out there for us if you look at those FAQs.
With a certain slant, yes, it's out there.
If I may.
Jump up and down.
I don't think we can afford to table this or to wait. I think we really need to make a motion to move this forward to Staff Alliance to really demand or request a health care task force be looking at outside options, alternate options, something. So I would so move to request that Staff Council take this to Staff Alliance and request that.
This is Gary Binder. I'll second.
Okay, is there any further discussion about creating a task force?
Just one question, and I've asked this before, and I just don't understand. Why is this something that JHCC can't do on their own?
Maybe Melanie might want to add to this, but essentially, my position when I initially proposed this was that JHCC has a role, and it's fed certain information, my concern is I want fresh eyes to some extent. I'd like to see if there's a combination of current JHCC members plus new members that makes up this task force, so that there are fresh eyes that are not caught up by our existing programmer. And so why aren't they doing it over and above what they're already doing? JHCC, as those of you that have served on SHCC know, they have a massive amount of information that they're processing all of the time. And why haven't they looked at it? I can't answer that specifically.
That's my understanding that the university, as it has at one time in the past, gone out to bid as far as outside insurance and healthcare, and it came back as less than, but it was also rejected for the higher the plan.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It looks like Melanie wants to.
Melanie, do you want to come forward and sit at the mic? And if you could explain what your role is just for those who have not met you.
Sure. Hi, I'm Melanie Arthur. I'm a member of the infamous Joint Healthcare Committee and a member of the faculty. And I just speak to the overlap about having a task force as well, and why that might be a good idea, even though we have a joint health care committee. And I'm always hesitant when we say we need a new task force for something. The task forces sometimes just fade away without, you know, you just wonder what happened to that task force. There's I've only been here 5 years, and there's several that I can think of that I'm like, what did happen to that? You know, there never was an outcome. In this case, I think that we have not gotten traction in the Joint Health Care Committee. It is not that we haven't, and despite what administration tells you in their Q&A, when they were angry because the news miner the information Ford, they did, about the health plan increases. But we have made proposals, even just in the last year plus a couple of months since I've been on the Joint Health Care Committee, about things that we could do. And they just really get pushed aside. Even things that they don't directly reject, they just sort of let lay there. One of the things we asked, just to give you a specific example, was in December, we made a motion that was passed and formally communicated by the committee to ask them, administration and their consultant, who they pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to give them the advice that they're acting upon or not acting upon, to explore getting some kind of clinic access, since our deductibles are now so high that you can't pay for a doctor's visit anymore. I mean, you pay for it out of pocket, right? At least one, maybe three, depending on which plan you're on. We asked them for an update on that. That was December when we made that motion. We asked them for an update on that last week, and their consultant came on the phone. He sits on the phone for the meetings and said, well, Erica gave me that name, and I'm getting ready to call her, which is just somebody over at the school board, because at the school district, because they have clinic access, right? That's part of their health plan. And he hasn't even called the person at the school district who might tell him a little bit about their access, not to mention doing nothing else to follow up on it.
Where does this person work?
Locked In Consulting.
Where do they live?
Dallas, Texas. So if a task force could get traction, could get somebody to pay attention, then I'd say, you know, absolutely do it. You know, we're putting in a lot of time and effort at the Joint Healthcare Committee. It's a personal obsession of mine. I just sat through your whole staff council meeting because I care that much. And but I'm frustrated as all heck. And as long as I've got the floor, just one more quick thing, if I could add one more thing. I don't have much direct path of communication to you all, but I do communicate regularly with my own faculty, and often they don't hear me, but I do my best to sort of tell them. We've seen a lot of this stuff coming and known that things need to be done. We just can't come to an agreement about what to do. It's really important that you should know that you need to look really closely when you make your decision about what to do for your own personal health care this open enrollment, which is coming up in just a few weeks. We have one health plan. We have no choice. There is an illusion of choice, but you should understand that if you look at the document, and you can look at the same document from last year because they haven't changed it and they won't change it. If you look at the document on the statewide HR site that compares the three plans, after you get past the first two lines, which are the deductibles and the out-of-pocket maximums, everything else, literally, if you created this table in Word, they've just merged the cells so that they go straight across the rows. Nothing is different about your benefit if you're in the high-deductible health plan versus the 500 plan, except how much money you choose to give the university or to give the health plan, really, because that's where it goes. We're a self-insured plan. That money goes to pay actual bills. And the vast, vast majority of our health expenses are actual medical bills. So the high-deductible health plan is the economically rational choice for almost every single employee at this university. You pay more for the other plans than the benefit justifies. That's an irrational system that administration is sticking with, despite having been informed, despite having a hundreds of thousands of dollar consulting company that's supposed to help them with their plan design. It makes no sense. And if we all make the economically rational choice, I also have to say as a disclaimer, they don't expect us to do that. They've sat at the table at the Joint Health Care Committee and said, our employees don't make economically rational choices. They don't pay attention and they won't notice. And they haven't planned for people to migrate in that way. If we do migrate in that way, the downside of that will be, you know, the $3.5 million deficit we just suffered, it'll happen again.
More people opting out.
And people opting out. And we actually, that was part of our Joint Healthcare Committee recommendation that they rejected. They projected 0% migration to plans. We got them up to 25%. Last year it was 40%. We also asked them to project some level of people opting out of the plan and therefore not paying in. They rejected that and said, no, nobody's going to opt out of this plan. And I'll tell you, I'm opting out of the plan, which I feel very conflicted about because I've put a lot of time and energy into it. And
Melanie, thanks. Yours was a strong voice today, and we appreciate you being here. And you made some very good points, some of which, we can talk later, but thank you for being here. Looking at the time and what's left on our agenda, we need to move on. So if we can get a kind of a consensus of what we would like to do, have you made a motion,
there's
John?
There's a motion on floor.
And somebody has seconded to move this forward to a task force recommendation to Staff Alliance, and that's where we are right now. So I would, if somebody would call for a vote, I would accept that, and we can move on with our agenda.
Sure. This is Gary Bender. I'll call for the vote.
Okay, everybody. I think we'll just do this quickly. In the room, if you could raise your hands, everybody in favor? Any opposed in the room? And online, everybody who's in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anybody opposed online?
This is Jennifer. I have one question. Will this task force work directly with the Joint Health Care Committee? Or will it be a separate task force doing the same thing?
Point of order. Sorry, Jennifer, but in the middle of a vote.
I know, but I wasn't able to pipe in a minute ago and ask the question because Pip's moved on.
Okay, let's I think the idea was that we would ask for a task force. How that ends up being set up at this point is we can't answer that, but we are asking for a task force to look at it.
Okay, I vote yes.
Okay, any opposed online? Okay, thanks. We will make that happen and move that to Staff Alliance. And moving on to we had added a conversation about the tuition waiver. We met with Donald Smith at Staff Alliance last week. I think you all in the room have a copy of both the proposed employee education benefit and a copy of the satisfactory academic progress statement. Do we have those online?
Yeah, I apologize to those online. I did not get it to Nicole in time to distribute. She sent it out. She has sent it out to you. I'm sorry about that confusion.
So we've talked about this for several months. I'm sure everybody's familiar with the topic. I guess I'd like to point out two specific pieces of information that I'd like you to be aware of on the employee education benefits which indicates that I'll just read it. Employees and qualified dependents are eligible for education benefits at the completion of the qualifying employee's probationary period. So that is one piece that is being kept in. Another piece that I want to call your attention to is that this benefit is tied to satisfactory academic progress, and that's J on the back. Those were the two items of concern that were brought up at Staff Alliance. We understand that this will probably be presented to the Board of Regents at the April meeting. So, as Juella said, this is a shift in the way that governance is afforded a voice with the way that we have been presented this information at the end of March that we now know will be probably presented to the Board of Regents in the April 12th meeting. It does not give us time to formally respond to a proposition, and I'd just like you to realize that is happening. Definitely a big topic of concern at the Staff Alliance meeting was kind of a disregard for the shared governance system, and it's important that you know there's a lot of issues on the table. These are complicated issues, but overlying all that is a shift of how the administration seems to be interacting with the other governing bodies, faculty, staff, students. I just want to reiterate that because it's an important distinction and one that is not readily transparent in all of our dealings.
I would like to add, I certainly agree with everything that Pips has just said. What this short notice does is it doesn't give you the opportunity to go back out to your constituents and get their feedback on these proposed changes. We did, as you recall, pass a motion opposing the original round of changes. Now we have another round, and this short notice doesn't give you the opportunity to get feedback. I will say, though, that Staff Alliance meets on April 10th, which is the Tuesday before the Board of Regents meeting. It's my intent to ask Alliance if they are comfortable taking a position on these changes and include that position in my testimony to the Board of Regents on the 13th or 12th. But today, again, it's up to you as a body representing others if you're comfortable taking a position on any of these proposed changes or if you would like more information.
I did have one quick question.
I'm sorry, online, we can't hear you.
This is Britton. Sorry, I just had a quick question about item A. It says the qualifying employee's probationary period. Is that specifically just the initial probationary period in which an employee is hired, or does that cover any probationary period in their employment here, for example, their promotions or reclassifications, the mandatory probationary period that is reinitialized?
Good question. We could certainly ask that be clarified, that it's qualifying employee's initial probationary period or something like that.
Yeah, I that would be valuable for me. For example, I take full advantage of the tuition waiver, and I'm currently in a probationary period now with the reclassification. So,
okay.
This is Robert Mankey. I asked that question or a similar question of HR one time, and they told me that once you're an employee of the university and you've gone through the probationary period once, if you get a promotion or another job, you do not have a second probationary period. But then again, they tell us a lot of things sometimes.
So he's...
Does anybody have any clarification on that?
Robert, this is Walker. I think that the probationary period, if you are going into a higher graded position, then you do have a probationary period there, but a like-level position, so like a grade 77 to a grade 77, You don't have a new probationary period because at the rate of pay they determined that you're already able, competent, and able to do that.
That would make sense. It sounds like though we might have a broader question than what Britton intended.
Yeah, we can look for clarification for that. Mary Alice, did you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. It says that it'll cover graduate level, but then it mentions on the backside that it doesn't cover 500 level or year long. What is a 500 level class? Because my understanding it's paid at the graduate level for that level.
Professional development course.
Yeah.
A 500 level class, for clarification, is a graduate level non-credit course. They're not eligible for degrees, for an actual degree. However, they're pretty sparse, but they're usually non-credit graduate level courses.
And they weren't covered before, apparently.
The 500 weren't?
Yeah.
But the year-long,
it wasn't specified.
The year-long has always been covered under the tuition waiver.
What we were told at Staff Alliance was that year-long classes were going to start being phased out. So there would be fewer and fewer until there were no year-long classes.
Hey, Pips and Joella, thank you. This is Jennifer. I have to excuse myself for another meeting. But I appreciate everything, so I will probably talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for joining us. Jed?
SAP on item 1C on the document describing SAP. It talked about student financial aid, and you cut off at 180 credits. I think a lot of employees, maybe non-traditional students, but to be cut off there.
Right. It was initially Alliance, UAA in particular, opposed applying SAP to the our tuition waiver, and we stated that again last week with him. We asked, you know, to remove employees. Maybe a middle ground would be dependents receiving education benefits. But he wasn't receptive.
I think on the front of the document, looking at increased credit hours and stuff, it looks good on the front. As soon as it gets to the back, it starts compressing. So when you look at the satisfactory academic progress and, again, the timelines, you know, the timelines are going to make it very difficult for staff, especially taking one or two credits here and there, trying to work and seek out a degree if that. I realize that there is a specification here as far as employees not needing to do the to be enrolled in the degree program. And also looking at withdrawals are dealing with Title IV funds. So to tie satisfactory academic progress into financial aid and Title IV, and it looks really good on the front, and then it really compresses and starts to really tear apart as you go through. So I'm looking at this going, these changes are wrong. And dealing with a limited time frame, I'd be willing to take the position of saying that we need to reject these changes as written.
Kayla? This is Kayla Hansen. A couple of things that I'm thinking of. First of all, I just applied into our graduate program and just filled out the FAFSA form. And after you get finished filling out the form, it tells you what the graduation rate is and what the retention rate is for this university. It was graduation rate 31%. 31%. This university has bigger issues going on than with this tuition waiver. Now, some of these changes, I'm going to almost agree with the university on it. However, they do want to look at DE. An employee may attend credit courses that do not directly benefit the university during work hours. Where I'm going to argue right now that any class they take, if they can get a degree in this, is going to benefit this university. Because 31%, oh my God, gross mismanagement, not just for our health care, gross mismanagement of this university. It behooves this university to get as many students out the door with a diploma, with a degree, with whatever. That includes their staff, which also could help in promotion, finding better jobs. So my thoughts on this is they can make these changes, they better think about 31%. And I'm going to print out my FAFSA, and as far as I'm concerned, I can send that around, because if that's what this university is up to, I'm really truly disgusted on so many levels. And then the idea of me going to this university as a graduate student, not just as a tuition waiver, but even if I was going to, let's say, leave the university to go to this university with this kind of graduation rate, with what they're doing, I'm not so certain I want to give any money to it this time around. So this university has to start thinking about what it's really going to take to move us forward and treat education and this department as a way of giving people a leg up. You know, I mean, seriously, we can create new jobs. We can do more research, but that includes getting everybody in the state a better education, including staff. So I'm done.
I agree with everything you just said. Just one other thing, though, in case you don't know it. It is customary at almost every single university, at the vast majority of educational institutions in the United States, tuition waivers are customary. When I left the University of Arkansas, not only did you have a tuition waiver, but there was no limit on credit hours. And that's true for most of your Midwestern and your Southern colleges. We've already got restrictions that are unusual for our tuition waiver, and further restrictions are counterproductive. Finally, it goes against the philosophical foundation of our being, in that we are supposed to value education and promote education, but yet they want to cut education and disincentivize furthering the education of people that work in an educational institution. That runs completely counter to our foundation and our alleged values.
Okay, so do I hear an intent or wish to take action?
I move that we reject these changes on the basis of our concerns about satisfactory academic process applying to employees and possibly limiting their benefit, and on the basis of something else, which I just forgot. someone wants to add that in. If there was another reason. And on the basis of the timeline, that we have we don't have a chance to respond to these changes before they're apparently going to be implemented.
A second.
Okay. Are we ready for a vote? We've had
this
enough.
This in turn would be forward to staff alliance.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. All in favor in the room, please raise your hand. Any opposed in the room? All in favor online?
Aye.
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 Is there any opposition online? Okay, motion passes. Thank you. We will bring that to Staff Alliance as well, and thank you for your conversation and thoughts and action. Thank you.
Can I just ask who drew this motion up?
Pardon?
Who drew all these?
These changes came from Donald Smith,
okay.
The same signer on the letter you received regarding your employee premium.
Okay, so we have moved on to committee reports. We'll go quickly through this. Staff Affairs has not met. We're still waiting for somebody to step up to chair Staff Affairs Committee. Rural Affairs, Brad, do you want to talk to say anything about Rural Affairs?
Everything's in the written report. If I have more details, I'll bring them next meeting, and Rural Affairs is meeting a week from today.
Thanks, Brad. Walker, EMR, would you like to say anything in addition to following Brad? Walker's still there? Okay, we don't have Walker. Debbie Gonzalez, do you want to talk about advocacy?
Only to apologize that I've done nothing. I think our committee is down to two members because Kat Williams resigned from staff council, so I'm just really short-staffed in my office and super busy, so I apologize for not having more time to give right now.
Thanks, Debbie. Moving on to Staff Alliance Staff Healthcare Committee. Carolyn, do you want to talk about SHCC for the last month?
We didn't have a meeting we did have.
We can't hear her at all.
I'm sorry. We had a meeting last month. Then it was basically the only thing that we talked about was a possibility of changing some of the ALEER program, and they had a presentation from, I can't remember the guy's name. I think he was with Alyeska.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about the program that they use and how much more user-friendly it is and better response to the staff. And so it was just it was basically just an information meeting, and they are going to talk more about it. They were trying to get more information, more specific. And I do not remember the name of the company that they were talking about.
That was patient care.
Yep.
Right.
We do have another meeting tomorrow.
Right.
Or Thursday.
Right. I Craig, who was the chair of SHCC, resigned from Alliance, and I appointed Melody Munson as his replacement for chair for the rest of the year. They brought a motion in support of the patient care additional benefit to our healthcare package to Staff Alliance. We rejected it, requesting more information on the program, et cetera, from SHCC, just so you know.
Okay, thank you, Carolyn. We'll move on to external UF committee reports. Those are the reports that we've received are attached, but I do want to allow time for anybody who would like to say something verbally. So if you have attached a report and you would like just to mention something or get feedback, please do so at this time.
From Communications Committee, maybe?
Not quite yet. We'll do that. Yes, that should be ad hoc. So this is just external committees.
Okay.
Yeah. And seeing nothing, we'll move on to ad hoc. Let's see, Staff Appreciation Day, Ashley was already here, which moves us on to communications.
Okay, so our report is, or our minutes from our last meeting are in as attached, but one thing we'd like to do is look at especially newer members of staff council as far as what questions you have, and we're trying to put together a frequently asked question sheet is for a quick result to get to information readily and quickly and have a source for more of a compiled question and answer stuff.
Thanks, John. Kayla, do you want to say anything about Chancellor's Cornerstone?
We have a committee together. We're meeting tomorrow, and we're going to go through, and we've sent out the 167-page document. We're going to review it and hopefully have recommendations to the Chancellor by the end of the meeting.
Great. Thank you for doing that. And then the only other award that I'd like to mention is the Outstanding Staff Council Award. I think Nicole's going to have that online. Is that right? Soon? She'll email the information to us. I think the deadline for nominating somebody is April 15th, but that will be coming up soon. Okay. Any questions about committee reports? Seeing none, let's turn off the recording, and we'll go quickly roundtable discussion.